This is Mike Harris on the Republic Broadcast Network, and today is Monday, March 19th, 2012. And I want to let you know that we've got a guest today. His name is Jeff Prager. He's been working on a new book, which is he's preparing to release this week, I believe. And the book is the definitive report on 9/11 and what really happened. And really, it's about the physics behind it. And so Jeff will be joining us shortly. And when he does, he'll be able to walk you through every explanation, every anomaly to explain all of the unexplainable things that happened with 9/11 so far. Now, a lot of people have been working on 9/11 for a long time, but Jeff thinks that he is he solved the riddles, if you will, of what 9/11 really is. And I want to welcome him to the show. Welcome, Jeff Prager. Welcome. You're on Republic Broadcasting Network.
Well, thanks for having me, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
But anyway, the warm-up I gave you before you joined us was that you have released the definitive work on 9/11 that resolves all of the anomalies that have yet to be explained by the other researchers, although many, many people are pulling in the same direction to try to solve this thing. No one except those who wear tinfoil hats believe what the government has to say anymore, as they've been completely debunked and disproven. And there's been some debate on the 9/11 truth side as to who really has the solution as to what happened. So I'd like to, you know, open the floor for you to explain to our listeners what your conclusions are.
Okay, I'd like to do that. You know, I first want to say that, you know, the post 9/11 effort to suppress public opinion or to create public opinion was far greater than the planning and staging of the event itself. Planning and staging the event itself was very simple. Dealing with public opinion afterwards was a complex a component of the whole agenda. So here's where I want to start. I want to start in 1961. In 1961, the Soviets exploded the largest nuclear weapon ever exploded on the planet. They called it Big Ivan. We called our bombs Fat Man and Little Boy. They called theirs Big Ivan. Big Ivan was a deuterium-tritium fusion weapon. It reduced fission radioactivity by 97%. And so that's where I want to start. So that's back in 1961. Now, nanotechnology has been mentioned in the 9/11 community repeatedly. And I want to make it clear that historically, nanotechnology is a child of the nuclear weapons laboratories. It's a creation of the weapons of mass destruction industrial complex. And the most far-reaching and fateful impacts of nanotechnology are seen in nuclear weapons. Now, there's a primary impetus for creating these systems, and that was the need for extremely rugged and safe arming and triggering mechanisms for nuclear weapons like atomic artillery shells. Some of your listeners might know about the Davy Crockett, which was a watermelon-sized tripod launched. Okay.
You bet.
So you know, historically, nanotechnology came out of the nuclear weapons laboratories. That's where it started. Now, in 2003, your listeners are probably familiar with JANES, which is, you know, the industry standard for weapons publication.
Which is JANES Defense, yeah.
Yeah. In 2003, JANES published an article where they warned that advanced technologies will be able to trigger a relatively small nuclear explosion involving a deuterium-tritium mixture and a device weighing no more than a few kilograms. And a deuterium-tritium mixture yields tritium and uranium. Those are the first two yields out of the fusion-fission process. High amount of tritium, very low amount of uranium. Average uranium in the United States, the low and the high, is between 12 and 40 becquerels per kilogram.
Hey, Jeff, here's our first break coming up, and we'll be back in 3 minutes, so hang with us, okay?
That's fine.
This is Mike Harris on Republic Broadcasting Network, and it's Monday, March 19th, 2012. And we're on with guest Jeff Prager, who is finally giving us the definitive answers on what happened with 9/11. And as many of you have heard me say before, we will have no peace or no justice in this country until we have an honest investigation and we indict the perpetrators of this crime. That being said, Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike. I'm glad you said that. Certainly, I have enough evidence in the dozen books that I've written to indict the perpetrators. One of my books is a forensic financial investigation, Global Finance, and it has photos and pictures of everybody involved in the event from top to bottom, people whose names you wouldn't even recognize. But anyway, back to what we were talking about. Uranium occurs across the globe. It's found everywhere. And we know how it occurs. We know the levels it occurs in. It occurs in a minimum and a maximum of between 12 and 40 becquerels per kilogram. Those are the normal low and high levels. This is where I want to mention the data that I'm using, because some of your listeners might think, you know, I'm making some of this stuff up. My primary data is the USGS, United States Geological Survey, Open File Report number 010429, Environmental Studies of the World Trade Center, where they did SEM analysis, scanning electron microscopy, of 35 sample locations across lower Manhattan surrounding Ground Zero. My second source is University of California, Davis, Delta Group, Dr. Thomas Cahill, world-renowned nuclear atmospheric physicist. And he did an analysis of aerosols from the World Trade Center. He set up on the roof of a building down there well after the event, about 30 days after 9/11. And for another 30 days beyond that, he measured aerosols. And then I'm also using the Purdue Nuclear and Many Bodies Theory Group from the Department of Physics at Purdue University in Indiana. One of their papers called Theory of Low Energy Deuterium Fusion in Micro Nanoscale Metals. Now, I have a lot of other resources, but those are my three primary resources. So getting back to the uranium, we know it occurs in between 12 and 40 becquerels per kilogram. The USGS study in lower Manhattan was on the 16th and 17th of September, just a couple of days after the event. They took 33 samples of dust from outside. I'm sorry, 31 samples from outside, two samples from indoors, and two samples from scraping the girder coatings, the box column coatings. The box column coatings had 93 becquerels per kilogram of uranium. That's more than double what the standard high should be. Now, these are box columns that are inside of a 1,000-foot building, and there is absolutely no explanation for 93 becquerels per kilogram of uranium on those box columns. And that's from the United States Geological Survey. That's good data.
Well, Jeff, one thing most people don't realize, and I was at the site of 9/11 as near as I could get to it in December of 2001, and people don't realize that the size and magnitude of these box columns, and they're approximately 3 foot on one dimension and probably 18 inches to 2 foot on the other dimension, and they're almost 3 inches thick per,
exactly.
per side.
Exactly.
And these things are enormous. And what they reminded me of when I saw them was gigantic waveguides. What a microwave waveguide looks like.
Uh-huh.
That's what they reminded me of. So anyway,
they're huge, and we have several of them. I probably have the most extensive collection of high quality, high resolution 9/11 images, and I have images from 9/12 and 9/13 of Ground Zero. Before it was excavated, while the rescue workers were there with their dogs. I have lots of photos, a couple of hundred of rescue workers searching with their dogs, real high resolution. So I can zoom in on these images numerous times. There is not a trace of an energetic compound. These 3 foot by 2 foot, 2.5 inch thick box columns are bent in U-shapes and even further than U-shapes. They're twisted, they're ripped, they're torn, bolts are ripped out of the flanges.
Let me give you some personal testimony here, because the ones that I saw were twisted and sheared.
Absolutely.
And, how do you take something with that much tensile strength and actually twist it?
Well, and, you can't do it with any type of nano-energetic compound. What happened with the deuterium-tritium explosion on a micro scale, with a bomb the size of an apple, everything is scaled down. So what you get is you get perhaps, and these are estimates, but perhaps within a 50-foot diameter of Ground Zero or a 25-foot radius, you'll get tens of millions of degrees. In the next 100 feet, so from 25 feet to 100 feet out, so 125 feet out, you'll get about 300,000 degrees.
So really what you're doing is extrapolating the inverse square law. And,
well, I'm taking a standard nuclear demolition of about 25 metric tons and reducing that to the equivalent of a deuterium-tritium demolition of a bomb the size of an apple. So you reduce everything. And essentially, outside of the Twin Towers, beyond the tower itself, that heat only may be extended another 100 or 200 feet. And then it dropped off to, you know, 90, 100 degrees at the very most. And what happens is that those tens of millions of degrees are reached in the equivalent of nanoseconds, just one or two nanoseconds, and it's done. The heat dissipates as quickly as it came on.
Let's explain for our listeners that a nanosecond is a billionth of a second.
Right. It is a billionth of a second.
It's a very, very quick
exactly.
Occurrence.
Exactly. And so when you heat up with fast neutrons, which is what comes out of a deuterium-tritium bomb, fast neutrons, which are attracted to metal, and they're attracted to moisture, so they're attracted to human beings, and they're attracted to metal, what you get is a dissociation. So when a human being is hit with fast neutrons from a deuterium-tritium bomb, they evaporate. And or they vaporize is a better term. When structural steel is hit by the deuterium-tritium bomb, it dissociates. And then, in the same rapid period of time, it resolidifies. But because the building is 1,000 feet tall, and it has over 200,000 tons of structural steel, cement, and other building components in it, it's under constant stress, tremendous stress. So when you dissociate the metals for just a few nanoseconds, wherever the stressed joints are is where stress failure occurs. Now, some of your listeners probably don't know Patricia Ondrovic, and they probably don't know Shirley Hooford. And I'd like to discuss them here just for a moment.
Okay.
Patricia Ondrovic is an emergency medical technician, Shirley Hooford is a 38-year-old Red Cross worker in the Dallas area. And they were both ordered to New York to begin working with victims and their families just after 9/11. And I want to quote from Shirley Ondrovic first. Shirley says, she said, "The thing that most stuck out in her mind after interviewing dozens of people was the number that told her of looking back as they were running away and seeing people engulfed in some sort of fireball and disintegrating." Now let's hear what Shirley Hooford had to say. Several victims told me they saw people engulfed in a fireball and disintegrating. One man said he was at work when he heard a loud noise, and at the far end of the cubicles, he saw a man running toward him with a fireball coming after him. The running man just exploded, flying into pieces. I heard stories like that from people from both towers. I don't know the physics, but at what temperature does a human vaporize? Now, these are from two emergency medical technicians. These are people you can find. They do exist. And that anomaly is solved with a nuclear explosion. There are numerous anomalies that people are just not familiar with, similar to those, and they're unbelievable. Larry King interviewed a couple of women. I don't have their names right here at hand, but King said, "So did you know you were on fire, in a sense?" And the woman, Yang is her name, she said, "No, I wasn't on fire. I think it was the heat." And what they were experiencing is a nuclear explosion is defined by rings or radii, and different things happen in those different radii or radiuses. And she was at a point of that nuclear explosion where she wasn't vaporized. She was experiencing 90, 100, 105 degree heat as she was running away. And, you know, these are anomalies that cannot be accounted for with nano-energetic compounds. There's another anomaly that's published also. If you search on the internet for firefighter testimony, you'll eventually find it. I don't have it right at hand, but there's a firefighter who testified that the clouds were sparkling and sizzling as they passed by. As he was hiding under the fire engine, he could hear the clouds sizzling, and he could see them sparkling. Okay? That's not nano-energetic compounds. That's a nuclear explosion.
So whenever you speak of nano-energetic, are you talking about the nano-thermite theories?
Whatever, yeah, nano-energetics. They're actually called metastable intermolecular sol gels. That's the term. But that term is so hard to get out that they came up with nano-thermite. Nano-thermite
okay.
doesn't really exist. It's metastable intermolecular sol gels. And then there's a variety of different types of those. There's thermite, which is not an explosive, it's an incendiary.
Right.
And there's thermate, which can, and thermite also can have explosives added to them. There is a thermite that has RDX added to it, and there's a thermite that has HMX added to it,
okay.
and they're both
yep.
explosive.
This is a good spot for our break to come in. We'll be back in 3 minutes, so hang with us, folks. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back. This is Mike Harris on Republic Broadcasting Network, and it's Monday, March 19th, 2012. We're on with guest Jeff Prager, who is dispelling many of the myths and rumors and disinformation of what really happened on 9/11. And hopefully this will help jumpstart and open an honest dialogue to where we can bring these perpetrators, these treasonous perpetrators and foreign nationals who did this to us to justice. So, Jeff, the floor is yours.
Okay, I'd like to quote someone else. Larry King interviewed a guy named Brian Reeves. Brian was a security guard in one of the towers. And I'm just going to quote from Brian on the Larry King show. Brian stated, "I don't know when I got burned, but I just know when it knocked me over, there was something. The windows blew out. And when the windows blew out, I was on the ground. And like I said, there was a gust of wind. And when I opened my eyes, I seen a bright orange light." That's a nuclear explosion. The guy got burned. Now, another anomaly people aren't familiar with, I'm sure, is that we had well over 1,000 burn victims that were treated in New York City on 9/11. And we, when you look at the data on the burn victims, it's obvious that a little over half, 57%, you can't figure out what their burns were. It treated for burns, but that's all you can find out. It says no more. Now let me speak about an anomaly that's very significant to me. This is very important to me. Multiple myeloma is a very rare plasma cancer, blood plasma cancer. The CDC did a study called the K-25 study. It's a study on nuclear workers. You can find that on the internet, just K-25-CDC. Multiple myeloma occurs in the general population at a rate of 3 to 9 per 100,000 people. It occurs in people 99% of the time over the age of 65 with an average age of 71. The first responder cohort is a total of 40,000 people. They have a multiple myeloma rate of their multiple myeloma rate is 187 per 100,000 people. Of all of the people that die, 127, not 187, 127 per 100,000. When it normally occurs, 3 to 9 people per 100,000 in the general population. The 40,000 cohort of first responders have a rate of 127 per 100,000 of multiple myeloma, a very rare blood cancer. Now, the CDC will tell you we do not know what causes multiple myeloma, except that we do know that workers in the nuclear industry that are minimally exposed and treated immediately have a 4% chance of an increase of multiple myeloma. Now, in World Trade Center, we've had 345 deaths as of March 1st, 2011, almost a year ago, 345 deaths from cancer, thyroid cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and multiple myeloma, along with three other cancers, pancreatic cancer, and I can't remember them all right now. the only time humanity has ever seen rapid increase in those specific cancers has been at Chernobyl, Nagasaki, and Hiroshima. No other time have we ever seen increases this rapidly and in this quantity of those types of cancers. That's an anomaly.
But let me give you a personal note here. My father died in 1997 of myelodysplastic myeloproliferative syndrome, which is, again, one of your multiple myelomas, a blood cancer. So, FYI.
How old was he?
61.
51, okay. That's unusual, but, of course, it does happen.
But he was exposed to nuclear radiation during the 1950s during a test.
Okay, then it's not so unusual.
So.
You can look up on the Internet. The statistics are pretty clear. 99% of the people that get multiple myeloma are over 65, and the average age is 71. So that is a little unusual, but he was exposed to nuclear radiation, so obviously, you know, he had an exposure level to deal with. You know, this is kind of the way I like to study these things. I really like to find hard facts and hard evidence that makes sense. And when you look at 9/11, and I don't think many people have seen the pictures of 9/11 that I've seen. I was able to download about 1,000 images from FEMA in January of 2002, and shortly thereafter they were taken off the Internet. But that's how I got the images of the rescue workers with their dogs all over Ground Zero. And they're huge. They're 30 inches by 18, 19, 20-inch photos and high resolution. So they're incredibly good photos. But I have the same photos of 9/11, of the actual event, of the event itself, taken from a plane rather close to the event. Most people have seen videos. They're not very good. You need to see the event from about 2 to 3 miles away to understand, to actually see that it was a nuclear event. You can't see that looking at most of the videos that are around. But if you can get pictures and video that are about 2 or 3 miles away and watch the event, you can see it was a nuclear event just by looking at it. But, you know, I've pretty much covered the ground I'd like to cover. Those are the things that are important to me.
Okay, well, Jeff, here's our break music coming up again. We've got this is a half-hour break, so we'll be back in about 3 minutes, and then we'll have some free time. If you want to open up for callers, we can do that after the break. This is Mike Garrett on Republic Broadcasting Network, and it's Monday, March 19th, 2012. We're on with guests. Jeff Prager discussing what really happened at 9/11 and one of the first plausible explanations for many of the anomalies that have yet to be explained. And Jeff, do you want to take questions now from listeners?
I do, Mike. I'd like to mention one more thing.
Sure.
Your listeners may be familiar with Dr. Christopher Busby, who I maintain an email relationship with. Dr. Busby is he has a first-class honors degree in chemistry from London University. He's got a Ph.D. in chemical physics from the University of Kent. He's the scientific secretary of the European Committee on Radiation Risk, and he's a member of the U.K. Department of Health Committee examining radiation risk for internal emitters. And I just want you to know something about Dr. Busby. You know, he's been to Fukushima, he's been to Iraq, to Fallujah, and done studies there, peer-reviewed studies. And, you know, everybody knows about depleted uranium. You know, we're using depleted uranium all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing here is that Dr. Busby found not just depleted uranium in Iraq, in Fallujah. Dr. Busby found enriched uranium in Fallujah. And he published a peer-reviewed paper just a few weeks ago about that in the U.K. Finding enriched uranium in the hair samples of adults in Fallujah means enriched uranium was used in Fallujah. So that being the case, we know the military-industrial complex has some type of very small nuclear bombs. All of my studies indicate they're deuterium-tritium bombs, and that accounts for the uranium in the hair samples. I'm ready for any kind of questions anybody might have.
Let me give out the dial-in number. It's 1-800-313-9443. And once again, for those of you who are like me, never have a pen or a paper around at the time, 1-800-313-9443. And typically it'll take a couple minutes to get them through the producer on the board, and then we'll have them a couple of minutes because people are anxious.
Sure.
I did have an email from a listener who wanted to ask about Judy Wood and your opinion and how her theories work, and are you willing to work with her, et cetera, et cetera. So,
I've investigated this. I've been retired for a very long time. I'm 56 years old, but I published a magazine in Phoenix. It was a very well-known magazine. I sold it and retired very young, and I've studied everything related to 911. I didn't throw anything out. I just said, look, I have to look at everything fairly, everything, and I have. I can't find the science to support Judy Wood's theories. The theories are theoretically viable, but there isn't any science to support them. I can find the science to support my theories. And I can tell you very clearly, these little apple-sized deuterium-tritium bombs, they're probably less than $5,000 a piece to make. When you look at the entire 9/11 feat, you don't want 300 guys wiring a building with explosives and energetic nanothermite for a couple of hundred days. Dr. Niels Harrit and Dr. Jones estimated between 29,000 and 144,000 metric tons of energetic compounds were used in the buildings. I took the low, the 29,000 metric tons. That would take 1,500 tractor trailers, and it would take people working, moving a one-ton box from inside a tractor trailer to its final destination every 15 minutes. That would have taken 100 days. So 29,000 metric tons as a low for Dr. Jones nanothermite is absolutely absurd. And I don't think Judy Wood's theories are as absurd as Dr. Jones's. Her theories, like I said, are
you just can't find the supporting science to
exactly.
go along
with. They are viable theories. And even though the nuclear science is buried deep, I can find the science to support my theories. It takes a long time, but it's there.
Well, the phones are lighting up already, and if you're ready for callers, we've got Lane from Fort Worth. Lane, welcome to the show, and good morning, sir. How are you?
Join your guest. Just a brief statement, and I have a question. A number of years ago, through work, I got involved and became real interested in the nuclear weapons, and of course, people think that right after the war that. We figured out how to do the hydrogen bomb and all kinds of stuff kind of stopped. Well, they never stopped developing nuclear weapons. They developed them, tested them, blew them up, and then it went underground, and it's just has gone on and on for decades. There's no doubt in my mind that they could make a micro nuke after this period of time to be, just what y'all have just been describing here. But what I wanted to, I'm sorry, what's your guest first name?
Jeff.
What's his first name?
Jeff.
Oh, Jeff, okay. Jeff, is there any relation to the Oklahoma City bombing and the tremendous heat? I've seen photographs of the cars outside. I mean, for a long way, these cars are just roasted. I mean, I just can't imagine anything, even conventional explosives, C4 or anything, which we think really brought that building down, producing that much heat. I mean, is there any tie-in to the Oklahoma City bombing with a mini nuke?
Hello, Jeff. Did you hear him? All right, he dropped off. We'll get him right back for your question here, Lane. I apologize.
That's all right.
No. These things do happen whenever we talk about sensitive subjects, in case you haven't noticed. I'm not joking around. I've had a lot of interference on my own broadcast and my own ability to communicate over.
I will say, since we got a dead minute, your show seems to get it worse than any.
Did we just lose Lane 2?
I'm here.
Okay, Jeff, now we lost the caller Lane. Lane, if you're out there and you can hear me, call back ASAP, okay? Jeff, did you hear Lane's questions?
I did not.
Okay, you did not. All right, well, we're going to try to get Lane back as quick as we can. In the meantime, let's go ahead and take Sean from Pennsylvania. Sean, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
Great program this morning. Thank you. Two questions. One, what would be the sound waves released from these explosions? And two, how can we disassociate it from the asbestos
as far as the cancers? Okay, asbestos doesn't cause cancer. Asbestos doesn't cause rapid onset multiple myeloma, rapid onset non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, rapid onset pancreatic cancer, rapid onset thyroid cancer. Asbestos affects the lungs, and we know from and I've studied this. I'm writing two pages in my book right now on asbestos. Let me explain something. Ground Zero had virtually no asbestos at it. If you look at the Avarice satellite images by the USGS, you'll see the asbestos was distributed north of Ground Zero. All of New York City had asbestos all over it. Ground Zero was virtually asbestos-free. And that's from the United States Geological Survey data. You can look it up yourself. You can type in fact, I can tell you what you can type in. You can type in on your computer to pull up that data. Just type in USGS. Open file report 01-0429. And you'll get a volume of data, and you'll get the Avarice satellite images that'll show you where the asbestos is.
Oh. Okay.
Now, what was the first question? The sound? Let me answer that question. We have a firefighter who gives testimony that this was the loudest sound he ever heard in his life. And every time he thought it was getting louder, it wasn't going to get any louder, it got even louder. That testimony will also be in my next book.
That was the concern as far as can we identify the explosions or what would the sound level be of these type of explosions?
The sound level would be loud, but it wouldn't be any louder than a 1,000-foot building, falling to pieces. You have to think about it. We're talking about 200,000-plus tons of steel and concrete dropping to the ground in less than 10 seconds. That's going to be pretty noisy.
Okay.
Well, Sean and Jeff, I got to tell you, we've lost two callers, we've lost the guest, and now you lost me on this. Now, I can't help but notice this is no coincidence. This seems deliberate. Somebody doesn't want this information getting out to the public. So we're gonna handcuff, and we're gonna be there. We're gonna get this information out, whether they like it or not.
Well, that's possible, Mike. Mike, my information is groundbreaking. I've got a 500-page book. I'm almost done with it now. It'll be out in a week or two. All my books are free. I post them to a dozen websites across the internet, so they're always there. And anybody can find me on Facebook, Jeff Prager, Prager, and my page on Facebook is open. So you can leave me a message, give me a link to your books, and I'll respond.
Well, I want you to let our listeners know where they can find your books before we lose you again. We want this information out there. We want the public to know that
it's The best way, the safest way is for your listeners to access me on Facebook. My name is Jeff Prager, P-R-A-G-E-R. My icon says Seek Truth, and my page is open. You can come and post a comment. You can post whatever you want. You can just write in a comment, hey, I'd like to get a couple of your books. And all my books are free, and my books have incredible pictures that can be zoomed repeatedly.
Okay, good deal. Sean, are you still with us?
Yes, thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay, Sean, well, thank you so much, and let's go ahead and we have Lane back, and after we have Lane, we'll go to Melody in Colorado. So, Lane, you're up next. How are you? Welcome back. Sorry about that.
I'm back, and my phone got hit even trying to call back. There's something really strange there, but anyway, what I was about to say, your show gets hit more than any of the others I've ever heard on RBM. It's really, really weird how that happens.
I must be poking the hornet's nest because you don't stay flat until you're
over the target. Well, my question for Jeff, I noticed going back to Oklahoma City, the Mira deal, that there were out, when you get a long-range shot of the building from the ground level, there were just parking lot full of roasted cars. I mean, it looked like they got hit with a flamethrower or napalm. And I just couldn't imagine how C4, Benjamin Parton said that his theory was forget the truck bomb. It was the C4 that did the real damage. I can't even imagine how the C4 could have roasted an entire parking lot of automobiles. So I just wondered if there any possibility they could have used a mini nuke in that explosion.
Sure, Lane, they did. I have some information that an ATF employee actually removed a couple of small nuclear devices from that building. I didn't study the Murrah building in Oklahoma City very closely, not as closely as I did 9/11, but I did work on it for probably 6 or 8 months. And that was a long time ago, so I didn't collect the information, so I can't go back and give you references. But I do remember a reference from an ATF employee who was speaking, off the record, that he did remove two very small explosive devices that he assumed were nuclear devices. There's no way the truck bomb could have done the damage that it did, and there's absolutely no way C4 or even RDX. Well, they're all about the same. TNT, RDX, HMX, C4, they all have a velocity of about 8,000 to 9,000 meters per second. And in order to destroy something, you need to reach the velocity of that particular item. So, for instance, concrete has a velocity of between 3,200 and 3,400 meters per second. So you've got to reach that to powder concrete. And the velocity of steel is about 6,000 meters per second. So you've got to reach that velocity to destroy the steel, to dustify or break up steel, disassociate steel. The velocity of C4 or anything else could not have done what we saw happen in Oklahoma City. These small nuclear devices have been used for years. We believe that the Beirut bombing, where the 200-plus American soldiers were killed, was a small nuclear device. We believe the Bali bombing was a small nuclear device. And there's another bombing I can't remember offhand that we also think was a small nuclear device. These devices are common. They're unknown by the general public. We don't know about them. But the military-industrial complex had a desperate need to come up with an explosive device that did not produce a tremendous amount of radiation and that could be used within the limits of the international treaties, which are very loose. The international treaties only cover plutonium and uranium. They don't cover anything else. So deuterium-tritium combination that produces very little radiation that only lasts for 5 or 6 days is what could be called, we refer to it as a green nuclear bomb, because essentially that's what it is. You know, we dropped a bomb on Hiroshima and killed 80,000 people in a nanosecond. We dropped a bomb in New York City and, you know, a few people died, but nowhere near 80,000. So,
Let me just close out my little comment here with a statement that the late William Cooper, he used to have a show on shortwave called Hour of the Time. He used to say this, and I've kind of adopted it. He said, the technology that exists at the core government level is 50 to 100 years ahead of what you're seeing on the street as state of the art. And I believe that.
Yeah, I don't know if it's 50 or 100, but I think it's probably at least 25 years ahead. And the advances are phenomenal now. I mean, you know, we make advances now in a week that used to take us, 6 months.
Sure. Well, the point is that it's way ahead of what we're seeing. Whether we can
absolutely
argue over the amount of years, but it's, that could make a whole show in itself. But anyway, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Well, Lane, thank you very much for your call. And let's go to Melody here from Colorado. Melody, welcome to the show and good morning. How are you today?
Hi, Mike and Jeff. I interviewed Colonel Dan Marvin, and he told me that he had been given an assignment over to carry one of those a backpack mini nuclear bomb to blow up the Aswan Dam, except that they never did do it. And then Dr. Deagle and Dr. Ed Ward both are consistent with what you were talking about on this nuclear weapon. And then I've heard some other with Lorraine Moray stating that there was something along that lines. And that's so I'm glad to hear that there's more evidence going along this direction, that somebody else is still doing more work in that arena.
Sure. I know Dr. Deagle very well. I've spoken to him frequently on the telephone. He's a pretty good guy. You know, this is a difficult subject to talk about. When the public realizes that that we were nuked by our own government, there's nothing worse. I mean, there can't be anything worse. And once the public realizes that, they're not going to stand for this regime that's in power.
Well, it's time for regime change, and there's our break music. We'll be back in 3 minutes to wrap this up. We'll be right back. Everybody hang on. Morning and welcome back. This is Mike Harris on Republic Broadcasting. We're on with guest Jeff Prager discussing 9/11 and what really happened, explanation for the anomalies. Melody, are you still with us?
I am.
Okay, good. Do you have any other questions for Jeff?
Yeah, I just also wanted to present the gentleman who did the film A Noble Lie I don't recall them coming up with any kind of evidence along this line stating that there had to have been evidence with the people in Oklahoma City that there was some kind of nuclear. Are you saying that you've got other evidence other than them taking out these bombs that didn't explode?
Oh, yes, of course. In fact, I posted my evidence to the CDC and NIOSH websites about a year ago when they were debating the Zadroga bill. I put together an analysis of the United States Geological Survey dust and followed the dust samples across 35 locations as they increased and decreased. And then using the product momentum correlation coefficient and something called the t-test statistic, we analyzed those dust samples, again, as they increased and decreased, and we can see decay path. We analyzed thorium, cerium, lanthanum, molybdenum, uranium, yttrium, vanadium, zinc, lead, copper, and a few other elements that were found in the dust with extraordinarily anomalous levels. The zinc was off the charts. The sodium and potassium were extraordinarily high. The vanadium was extremely high. The uranium was elevated. The thorium and uranium correlate
really,
to
it. Jeff, what I'm hearing you say here is that you have indisputable evidence that there was a nuke used at the Murrah building.
Oh, absolutely. No, I'm talking about the Twin Towers.
Okay.
Oh, the Twin Towers.
Okay.
I thought you were asking about.
Well, we're down to our last 2 minutes here, Melody, so I want to give Jeff a chance to close up. And Jeff, tell us what the implications are for the American people that our own government may have used nukes against the population.
Well, the implications aren't any different than they've ever been. I mean, our own government used nuclear weapons against our military personnel and denied having done so until about the year 2000, after most of them had died. So we denied Agent Orange up until recently. And now we're denying different syndromes from Iraq and Afghanistan. The consequences are always the same when you give people power and don't participate in government, which is what we have. We have 330 million people that don't participate in government, that just elect a president and, hope for the best for the next 4 years, but they don't participate in politics at all. I'm guilty of that, too. I don't either. I can't say I'm any better than anybody else, but, you get what you pay for, and if we're not paying for it, we're not going to get it. And I think what we'll see is a closing down of our society. We can see already what happened in the Weimar Republic.
Well, one of my premises on this show is that we have a cancer in our government, and it's time for a regime change, and it's time for a revolution of thought in this country to where we change how people think, where we change how people think and how people respond and how they participate in their own form of government. The time is now. And, Jeff, we're out of time. I'd like to invite you back anytime you want to come. This is a fascinating subject, and we'll be back tomorrow. So.
Well, Mike, you got my number. You can call me anytime. It was a pleasure talking to you, and I want to thank you for having me.
All right, Jeff. Well, I look forward to reading your book. Thank you very much, and we'll be back tomorrow, folks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.